Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. I'm Phil Bauermaster, and this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of the Speculist weblog, and you can find us online at speculist.com, S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Fast Forward Radio and the Speculist deal with positive change, accelerating change, neat stuff that's happening, the future as it unfolds, emerging technologies, and other fun things. And with me, as always, to talk about these topics is my co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm excellent. Basically, if you like geeky things, you'll like this show.
Well, I think so. I think that, you know, we aim to please. And, and you know, I think we've taken geeky stuff and we've broadened its audience a little bit. That's what I like to...
But we were geeks before being a geek was cool, right?
I know I was. One of the great surprises of my life is that being a geek ever got even
a little bit cool.
And we're going to be getting into that a little bit later. We're going to be talking about geek culture and what it means to be a geek today as opposed to what it meant a few years ago. But first, I want to talk a little bit about. Hope you had a pleasant weekend.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was really good because my college team, LSU, won the Southeastern Conference, and real proud of them. And believe it or not, Phil, I had written off any chances of a national championship.
Well, we said last week you said it couldn't.
Yeah, happen, so. It just simply was out of the cards, and according to the experts, there was no real chance. Well, the right teams lost, and LSU won, so that there is a small chance now of them playing for the national championship again.
Well, so they caught a break. And they won again.
And they won, and they won their conference, and they'll be in the Sugar Bowl, and maybe playing for the national championship also in New Orleans. So
we know who they're playing in the Sugar Bowl.
I'm sure someone does.
Okay.
But I don't have that in front of me.
If someone wants to call in or join us in the chat room and let us know, we'd appreciate that information. Well, I have no football news to report. The Broncos didn't manage to pull it out once again this week against those wonderful Oakland Raiders, our all-time favorite team. So I spent the weekend, I was just doing a lot of holiday stuff. Friday night was my wife's company's holiday party, and so I had to get, you know, all dolled up and be on her arm and, you know, try to make a good impression and everything. It's fun to compare because next week we've got my company's holiday party. So we got these back to back on Friday nights, and we compare who's got the better one. I think hers will end up having been by far and away the much better one. So,
well, and by better you mean what exactly?
Let me tell you where they had it. They had it at Invesco Field at Mile High.
Okay.
And what they did was they took the whole club level of the stadium and just dedicated it to this party. So it was nice. They had a dance floor going. They had food, they had beverages flowing, they had a whole, it was casino night, so they had all these, craps tables and blackjack, and I was playing my game roulette, which I believe I've mentioned on the blog before, that although, you know, theoretically, it's mathematically impossible to beat roulette, I've still got this idea somewhere in my head that I think I can beat roulette, so...
Well, more power to you on that.
I experimented some more with you know, just because mathematically it's not possible. I don't let that slow me down, you know. So we played some roulette. I just had a really good time. But she's kind of important in her company. I'm just kind of a schmo in mine. So this was kind of the important one, and I had to be on my best behavior. And
if you're a schmo, chances are you could, you know, if you impress the right person next week, you know, it might be actually more important for your party.
Right. Well, if she impresses the right person, who knows?
That's true.
Because I've had my shot. Let's face it; it's not gone anywhere. But all this seasonal stuff. The thing I was going to say was while I had the game on, was putting out all of our Christmas decorations, and we must have gone through I'm going to say $150 worth of extension cords this weekend, okay? I mean, it's like, you know, the fourth or fifth trip to Home Depot, and you just walk in, and they're all like, oh, hey, you back for more extension cords? What's your deal, you know? It's like, you know, we think we've got it all figured out, and then it's like, oh, we need a couple more. Well, she wants some green, you know. Oh, you know, we need this kind. And so I spent a good part of the weekend putting up different lights and displays and all these kinds of things. But extension cords, all right, they come in packaging, and you take them out of the packaging, and you think, well, here's one end, here's the other end. I ought to be able to just pull the two ends and have a nice straight cord, right?
Right.
Even if it's a 8-foot cord or if it's a 25-foot cord or if it's a 100-foot cord, whatever, I ought to just be able to pull those two ends and have a nice straight cord. But no.
It knots up on you or what?
Yeah, you pull those two ends, and you get like the Gordian knot. Okay. And, I mean, I had different brands. I had, you know, different kinds of packaging, and it always was the same. Every single one of these, I had to, like, do this thing where you pull it out, and you flip it all the way around, and you pull it out, and you flip it all the way, and you have to do, like, you know, 25 of these just to get the thing out and straight. And what I started thinking about, I don't know, on the third or fourth cord as I'm doing this, is I was thinking, okay, now, Stephen could probably look at this cord and immediately understand what you need to do to pull it straight apart because you know how to solve Rubik's Cube.
Well, I tell you, I'm a pretty mechanistic solver of the Rubik's Cube. It's like following a recipe in a cookbook. A great chef, you can put them in a kitchen with ingredients and they can make a great meal with no cookbook in sight. But you know, with me, I need to have a cookbook, okay?
So what you're telling me is you know how to solve Rubik's Cube, but you don't really understand how to solve
exactly. It. I know a way to solve the Rubik's Cube based on just, you know, follow, do this at this point and do that at that point, and, you know, and ultimately you've solved the Rubik's Cube. I have no great in-depth understanding of that cube, and actually learning how to do it, what it's managed to do is impress me as to the genius of those who really do understand those things.
So what I need is the guy who wrote that book. I bet he could get an extension cord. You know what? I bet he opens an extension cord and just pulls it
comes right through. You know, I wonder why they do it that way, because, you know, it'd be real easy to package it where it would come out without a problem.
You would think, you know? I mean, that's what I think myself.
It makes me think that they did it on purpose for some reason. Maybe they figured if you'd have to take it out of the packaging completely in order to, you know, you couldn't slip it back easily into the packaging, therefore you couldn't take it back so easy.
I don't know. It's OSHA. I think it's an OSHA regulation that
it must be hard.
It have to be hard to unravel. But whatever it was, that was my biggest frustration of the.
I got to give you a toy recommendation. If you've got a geek on your Christmas list, you've got to get. Well, anybody really would enjoy this. It's a game called Say What.
Okay, Say What.
Say What with a question mark. Okay,
it's a board game or what kind of a game is it?
No, it's like an electronic game. Okay,
okay.
And it's got five balls lined up. Okay, and these are these little balls fit into this, you know, little grooves. Okay. And what happens is you turn it on and it asks, are you ready? And, you know, you hit a button to say yes. And then it lists out a phrase, you know, now is the time for all good men to, you know, come to the aid of their country or something like that.
Right.
But it'll be a phrase and it's all mixed up. I mean, and country, come to the aid, you know, and each ball lights up for a certain portion of the phrase. But it's all mixed up. And then you've got to move those balls around.
Hmm.
To straighten out the phrase.
Oh, to get them in the right order.
That's right. So you have to have memorized in your mind what part of the phrase each ball represents, and then you move it around to do it. And then, of course, you know, each round gets a little faster, and you got less time to do it, and maybe the phrase is a little more complex. It's fun.
That sounds like a lot of fun. What's it called again?
Say What.
Say What.
Yes. Say What. It's a question mark at the end of it.
Yeah, we can put a little Amazon link for people to order that.
Oh yeah, it's I got it from my kid. It was sort of a birthday thing, and
okay.
So yeah, he's one of these unlucky kids that have a
December birthday.
Yeah, the birthday real close. So anyway, yeah, I can highly recommend it. We've already had a lot of fun with it.
Well, now how unlucky is it? Did you tell him that was his birthday gift and his Christmas gift?
I've never asked him to take a present out from under the tree and say, there's your present.
There's your birthday present.
Yeah, you know, good luck getting another one under the tree for Christmas. I've tried to make that as pain-free as possible that his birthday is this time of the year. But
you're a good dad.
Well, you know, the extended family is not always that easy on them.
But. You know what that sounds like when you describe it? Remember Simon?
Yeah.
This is like the, you know. The
Simon Says and all that, yeah.
No, there was a game called Simon, and it was like one of the earliest electronic games back in the 80s. And it was just this pattern of colors, and it would punch it out, and then you would punch them back in, and then it would do a more complicated one, and you would have to repeat it, and then it would do a much more complicated one, and you would have to repeat it. It didn't have the same, obviously it wasn't as sophisticated as the game you're talking about, but it's the same kind of principle where it goes faster, and you're having to deal with more and more variables as you go.
Yeah.
But that's probably before your time. So.
I think we may have our guest already on the line, Phil. That doesn't mean, let's proceed however you'd like, but I wanted to let you know that.
Okay. Well, I told our guest that we'd be bringing her on after a very special feature we're bringing back for the second time this evening, and so why don't we go straight into that then?
All right.
It's time for yet another... I hope I didn't talk over it.
Yeah, I think
play
we did.
It one more time. Better do it one more time.
All right. Well, just for fun, let's do it again.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so our Tales of the Paranormal this evening, I got a really good one for you, Stephen.
Okay.
We've got the Association for the Study of Unexplained Phenomena has completed work on a prototype device that they claim to be a working telephone to the dead. All right?
Sounds handy.
Oh, yeah. Almost a year in the making.
Almost a year in the making.
It's been almost a year. The R&D team at ASUP, now ASUP, of course, that's the Association for the Study of Unexplained Phenomena, they say that the preliminary testing suggests that the box does appear to create coherent words and phrases. In fact, team engineer Ron Ricketts has reported that while still working on the device on a workbench with the system running, the speaker said his own name very clearly on three separate occasions.
Well, that proves it.
This guy, he's working alone, and he's hearing his name being spoken by a box. So it sounds to me like absolute proof of the paranormal.
Well, I look forward to reading the article in the journal Nature.
Yeah, well, it should be coming up soon.
The
group is making no advanced claims for what they call the mini box. Apparently, this is a smaller version of a telephone that was invented a telephone for speaking to the dead that was invented some time ago. Except they say that it will begin field testing of the unit and it will be made available to anyone seriously interested in studying it. And it has a patent pending. But it gets better because the ASUP's director of operations, April Slaughter. Is that a great name? I mean, we got the names of these people: Ron Ricketts, April Slaughter.
Well, I guess
fun.
I can't help that, but oh well.
Well, no, people can't help their names. It's just they're so appropriate. It's just April Slaughter. She's part of the ASUP, you know.
Okay.
She's explained that the group is not in the business of selling technology, but the mini box will be made available to anyone interested by the first of the year through a separate company that specializes in high-tech gear for paranormal investigators. See, now, if we had any ambition at all, Stephen, we would have started a company that specializes in high-tech gear for paranormal investigators some time ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, like I say, we have compared ourselves to the Ghostbusters in the past, and all we need is some gadgets.
We just need a few good gadgets.
Yeah, that's it. That's all we need.
I think we need one of these phones.
Yeah.
And then we could get the dead on the line. Talk about your guests. We could have, Elvis on the show.
That would be great.
The story goes on. They say they got plans to test the machine. This is obviously a few weeks ago because they said they were going to test it November 16th at the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park.
What's the Stanley Hotel famous for? Why that place?
Well, you know, that was the inspiration for Stephen King's novel The Stand. So it's famous, renowned as kind of a haunted hotel. And if I'm not mistaken, the Ghost Hunters were just there on Halloween. They did a live show there on Sci-Fi.
You know, I think Michael Sargent mentioned that on a prior show, Fast Forward Radio. He mentioned that they were out there recently.
Well, I'll tell you what. After I read the story, I got so excited that I did a big Google search, and I've looked all over the web, but I've so far found no news as to what happened at the Stanley Hotel on the weekend of November 16th. So I can only conclude that the initial tests of this amazing device have proved so absolutely astounding and overwhelming in their results that the investigators dare not go public with the results.
For fear of just rocking the world with their results. That's awesome.
Absolutely. So if anyone has any information on what really happened at the Stanley Hotel November 16th, I want you to call Stephen at his home and talk to him all about
yeah.
it. Come by his house.
Or call in the show. That's what we really want.
What did I say? I meant to call.
Yeah, him. Yeah. Call us at.
Okay. Oh, I guess that means we're done with
it. I think so. Let's bring our guest on. Why don't you introduce her?
All right, absolutely. Well, tonight we're very pleased to have PJ Manny with us. PJ is a writer and futurist. She's based in Los Angeles, California. PJ is on the board of directors for the World Transhumanist Association, and she's a senior associate at the Foresight Nanotech Institute, and she's on the scientific advisory board for the Lifeboat Foundation. Now, PJ comes to the world of the future by way of Hollywood, where she was involved in the development of such movies as Hook and It Could Happen to You and Universal Soldier, and she was also a writer for two of our favorite TV shows on Fast Forward Radio, Hercules and Xena Warrior Princess. PJ is currently working on a novel which she describes as a political techno-thriller, which promises to have some fun stuff about human enhancement and nanotech right up our alley. So we're really looking forward to seeing that. PJ, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Thanks for having me.
We're so delighted that we were able to set this up. And we got a lot of stuff that we could get into this evening, but I thought we would start out. We had swapped some emails about an essay that you've written. Well, actually, I don't know how recently. I've read it recently, so it seems recent to me. But an essay you wrote on the subject of technology and empathy. Could you give us a little bit of background on what led you to write that and what that deals with?
Sure. The World Transhumanist Association had talked about doing a book of essays on transhumanist subjects, and I had been talking on the chat lists with this group about issues of empathy and technology, and it got a big response, and it seemed to beg some writing on it. So I offered the idea, and they took it. Now, unfortunately, the book has yet to find a publisher, so it's on my website, the essay.
And we'll be providing a link to that on the Speculous web notes.
That's great. Thank you.
For that, so folks get a chance to take a look at that. Hopefully they'll find a publisher for that. I think that sounds interesting. What were some of the other topics that were in the book?
Oh, golly. Transhumanism is a big subject. They covered a lot of ground, but they had some really interesting writers as well, people like Bill Bainbridge and George Dvorsky from Canada. I don't know if you know his work.
Oh, yeah.
We know
yeah.
George, sure.
George. You know George. Everyone knows George. And it was really, there was an awful lot of subject matter from ethics, bioethics, oh, golly. Where do you begin?
Yeah, well, just the gamut, everything that WPA deals with.
Yeah.
That's, putting her on the spot like that, Phil, is a bit like asking us, what have you written about at the Speculist?
Right. Well, yeah. that's easy for me. I would come back and I would say,
A lot of stuff. A lot of stuff.
Yeah, I'd bring up the most recent one. Just start reading.
That's right.
So, sorry, PJ, I didn't mean to put you on the spot with that.
That's okay. What it did get me thinking, though, was, you know, for me, empathy has always been the big issue, whether it's thinking in terms of the future or thinking in terms of the present, because all you have to do is look around you and see how a lack of empathy has really gotten us into pretty much all the trouble we get into, be it wars, be it misunderstandings, be it hatreds, et cetera, generally stems from a lack of empathy. The issue in the future becomes even more dire because you have the problem of what happens if we no longer are the same people, meaning there's some people who are enhanced, some people who are not enhanced. What if the species starts to split, which is, of course, one of the big issues in transhumanism.
Right.
I'd like to put it out there right now that I am not a techno-utopian. I do not believe that technology will save us. I believe that technology is completely neutral, morally neutral. For every stick we use to dig up food. We used another one to bash someone's head in. So really it depends on how we use it is how it's going to affect us.
So if that's true, let's start with that.
Okay.
If it's true that every stick we pick up, we can either, you know, plow a field or plow into the neighbor's yard or something like that.
Right.
is there really then a problem with technology making us any more or less empathetic or making us more or less anything? I mean, if it's neutral, is it really reasonable for us to worry about whether technology reduces our level of empathy?
Well, again, it's all how it's used. The whole idea of turning swords into plowshares goes the other way, too. You can use any technology for good purposes or for bad purposes, for empathetic purposes or for manipulative purposes. And especially with communications technologies, when you're talking about things from, for instance, existing technologies that we have now, like gaming, where you have these massive multi-user games, for instance. This is something, when you think about it, is an extraordinary advance in entertainment and communication. How are we using it? There's traditional gaming, like we're used to seeing the shoot-em-ups and single-shooter games, things like that. But there's a whole new group of gaming and gamers that are developing called serious games. There's a man named Ian Bogost, for instance, at a company called Persuasive Games, who writes on the subject. In fact, I think MIT just published a book on the subject about the power of using gaming to really change people's minds about things. Now, here's where you get to draw the line for good or for evil, if you will. Do we persuade people to understand bigger issues, to understand people we've never come to, we don't know, and who might consider the other, and the other is usually the person, the group people who are demonized within a society. They're often from another culture. Or are we going to use it to condition us to abuse the other? Now, for instance, I've just read about a Swiss site, and I'm going to have to try to find the links for you for this because this is brand new information to me. A Swiss site, a Swiss political party, which has some serious racist overtones. In fact, they have billboards where they have three white sheep kicking a black sheep off of the Swiss flag.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, I mean, serious stuff.
I've heard of these guys. I think Little Green Footballs has been all over these guys lately.
Yes, exactly. Well, they're now using games to promote their racist cultural Swiss agenda.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Or you can look at, for instance, the Left Behind game series. Now, there's a game series that sends shivers up my spine. You get to play being on the side of Jesus' army, whose goal is to basically kill all the non-believers. It's like, whoa.
Apocalyptic there.
It's exactly. Now, we know that when you immerse yourself in a story, and this is where the essay sort of comes around for me, when you immerse yourself in a story, you put yourself in the shoes of someone who you are not. Now, traditionally, when we are doing storytelling, be it in a novel, short story, but it can also be television, movies, games, this person is someone who we're not familiar with, we're not necessarily a part of their culture, but we learn how to be in their shoes and feel for them and feel for their understanding in things. Now, in the history of storytelling, and certainly in the essay I talk about the history of the novel, which is about a 1,000-year-old storytelling form, if you follow the history of the novel, we very clearly have followed social liberalization in world culture follows right on the heels of these stories being told, whether it's equal rights for women, the plight of the poor, orphans, etc. If you look at so much of literature, often the underdog is the person whose shoes you're in.
I think in the essay you mentioned Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Well, that's the biggie, because that book, that was the second biggest, most read book in the world in the 19th century. The first was the Bible.
Wow. Number
two in the world was Uncle Tom's Cabin. And when you realize that almost every literate American read that book, and Abraham Lincoln himself thought the book absolutely helped bring about the Civil War,
mm-hmm.
because it galvanized the North. Even people who never thought of themselves as abolitionists suddenly started thinking, wow, you know, this slave thing, this is way worse than we thought. I don't think we should have slaves. It became a new thought for a lot of these people.
Yeah.
People who had never been politicized before became politicized. And interestingly, the book also, I mean, from the worldwide cultural standpoint, the book got read by a lot of other colonial cultures who felt that their people were being enslaved. This wasn't just read by Americans,
right?
Which is why the book has had so much power globally. But that's certainly the huge example. But you know, you can look at, you know, Dickens and Dostoevsky and E.M. Forster, and you think of almost any major great novelist has done something to open up our minds about a group or a type of individual who we would have considered less than at a certain point in our history.
Right. I was just thinking, if you've ever seen, I think it's in The King and I, but I know it's definitely in the remake, Anna and the King. There's this exchange between this British woman who's a teacher and the King of Siam, who's not unsympathetic to President Lincoln, who had even written him a letter about how he could send him some elephants if he wanted to help him win his war.
Yes, I remember that. It's very cute.
But who under no circumstances wanted that book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, distributed widely in his country. He didn't want people reading that book at all, because for exactly the reasons that you were talking about.
Very dangerous ideas.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Ideas
are always dangerous.
Yeah, the most.
Yeah.
So my big concern in terms about bringing this back to technology is that if you can use storytelling to create empathy, you also can use storytelling to destroy empathy. And we've seen that in our history as well, where propaganda is often used to create the enemy, the other, to demonize them, and which only, again, creates more conflict.
You know, I think that one important thing about empathy is that it's always easier to hate somebody you don't know.
We're wired for it.
Yeah.
We're actually wired to hate instead of to love. You know, that's what the fascinating thing to me, again, when this now very early study of mirror neurons, which is, I think, some of the most fascinating neuroscience that's going on right now, is, first of all, empathy is not just a human trait. It seems to be a mammalian trait. They can see modeling behavior in mice and rats. They've done tests where if one mouse sees another mouse suffering, it suffers too, and it actually suffers in the parts of the brain where the other mouse is suffering, I mean, in terms of its neurons. So this is something that mammals are wired to do if we have someone to model. On the other hand, we also know from neuroscience that we're wired to look at everybody who's outside of our family group or our tribe as the other.
And that might not even be the mammal brain. It sounds like that's like the reptilian brain.
Right, exactly. That's pretty much every animal brain.
Right.
And we can't forget that that's what we are.
Yeah. Well, and I guess that's where transhumanism comes in, the opportunity to perhaps rewire ourselves.
Here's, if I may go back for one second.
Sure.
Sort of my take on transhumanism, because it will just affect the rest of the conversation. You know, I think we're already transhuman. I think transhumanism, personally, is a word that people have attached themselves to because it symbolizes something to them, the progression of the species, the improvement of the species, etc. But to me, we have always been doing this. We are a tool-making species. We have always been improving ourselves. Clothing, eyeglasses, you name, Phil and I talked about this some at the Foresight thing, even the idea of writing technologies. We're now, you know, from the moment we started writing 5,000 years ago, we were able to put some of our memory someplace else and not have to worry about it and come back to it whenever we needed to. So we've been improving ourselves for thousands of years. And if you look at some of the recent studies by evolutionary biologists saying that we are in fact biologically evolving much faster than we anticipated, you know, the whole idea that we were somehow the end point of humanity, why anyone in their whole life would ever believe that, I can't imagine calling yourself a scientist and ever thinking, you know, this was it. We have achieved it.
We have arrived.
Right, we have arrived, exactly. So the fact that we are evolving biologically anyway, the fact that we have had our own evolution in our hands from, in a crude way, for thousands of years, and in a unbelievably refined way coming into this century, where we really have our own evolution in our hands, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. This is when we can't say do-over and pretend it never happened.
So the process of becoming transhuman, or actually,
we are transhuman. You're transhuman. I'm transhuman. You know,
okay.
There is no human as well. This is the poster child for human. There is no picture in the dictionary that sums up everything that ever was or ever will be human. It's a continuum.
Right. Okay, let me just stop to say this is Fast Forward Radio on Blog Talk Radio. We're talking with PJ Manny. If you would like to call, if you have a question for PJ, you can dial in at 347-215-8972.
PJ, I recently told Phil that I claim Google as part of my brain now.
Oh, me too. I swear, you know, it's gotten to the point, and it's really embarrassing because I don't know if you guys have kids, but, you know, I've got school-age children, and it's, Mommy, I have a question. And, you know, my son's in sixth grade, so he's studying right now, you know, ancient civilizations. And, Mommy, so what's the big deal about ancient Egypt? You know, I was like, honey, wait a second.
Yeah, give me just 1 minute here.
Give me just 1 minute.
What does Wikipedia say?
Yeah.
And honestly, I scan the wiki, and I can spout out, you know, the salient points of ancient Egyptian culture. It's extraordinary. You know, I joke about between iPods and the research I can do on Google, I am a different person than I was 10 years ago.
There's no
question
that we are. I was just talking to Stephen about this before the show. I was frustrated because there were a couple of sites, there were a couple of stories that I'd seen in the last couple of weeks that I thought related to things we were going to talk about tonight, and I couldn't find them. And the reason I couldn't find them was because I never blogged them.
So the blog is a part of your brain. Your brain now.
Right. It something is part of my, you know, my ongoing experience. If I put it in the blog, and I was doing Google searches on all these phrases that should have found it, and none of it did, and I'm like, I'm really annoyed because I know if I had blogged that, I would know exactly where to find it, and it would be part of, you know, like my conceptual space, and it's not because I didn't blog it. I'm this symbiotic creature between, you know, this human and my blog now.
It's so true, and it's funny because I find that when my internet goes down, oh my God, I really truly, when we moved this summer, we had a horrendous time getting Verizon to hook up our telephones. It ended up taking 6 weeks. And for those 6 weeks, I had no internet.
Ooh.
And for someone like myself, who's a writer, who I live on the internet, my book is unbelievably high-tech oriented, and I'm constantly researching. And it's just high-tech oriented. It's you know, a political thriller, so it's about politics and American history and everything else. I was dead in the water. I was dead in the water from communications, from emails. You know, I'm sorry. I'm totally, I'm mind melded.
But
I could lose the TV a lot easier than the internet.
Oh, I can go for weeks without television.
Yeah,
I cannot go without the computer.
Plus, you can always watch something on YouTube if, if you're dying to.
Well, that's
something.
It, exactly.
But surely during that time, then you were able to get out novels and read and build your empathy for other people, right? Isn't that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's, you know, one of the things that there's a wonderful novelist named Jane Smiley, Pulitzer Prize winner, who wrote a book called 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel. And she actually talks about how novel reading builds empathy. And again, she doesn't say, there's no causality. She doesn't say that if you don't read novels, you will not have empathy. However, she also makes the correlation that people who are narcissists don't read novels, which I thought was fascinating. That they've actually done a study that narcissists don't read novels.
Well, what they think that their lives are
that's the only
so
story
much
we're
more
telling.
They're so much more interested in themselves.
How would they, how would any of that stuff be interesting to them?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that struck me was the idea that maybe visual forms of storytelling and maybe interactive by extension, although I don't think you said that necessarily, don't bring about this quality of empathy the way, say, reading would. What's the difference between them? Why would that be the case?
Well, and this is actually something I would love, if anybody is out there listening, I would love somebody to do a real scientific study on this, because this storytellers will tell you that the non-visual story creates a deeper psychological experience than the visual story, because what you do is in your mind's eye, you create the story. So if you're reading or if you're listening to a storyteller, whatever that input is, you're taking your personal experience, and which includes your imagination, because that is actually part of your personal experience, and you're creating that world in your mind. That reinforces, and if you think of it from a neurological level, you've already got the neurons there, you're just reinforcing that.
Mm-hmm.
That creates a much more powerful empathetic experience than visual storytelling, because you're getting that from the outside. It could be not at all how you imagined it. I mean, imagine all the books you've seen made into movies, and you go, that's not how I saw it at all.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Oh,
like that. Right, exactly. You cast who? So it's a very, interestingly, it's a more passive experience. To watch something. Now, gaming is not a passive experience. Gaming is, I guess what they call it, it's the lean-in versus lean-back technologies.
Right.
Lean-back is television, lean-in is gaming. So it's certainly not passive at one level. But again, on another level, you're not creating that world. Someone
right.
has created that world for you.
Skull cinema is the way Stephen King has always described novels. I think that you know, you really are. I mean,
correct.
You have to create the whole world inside your brain.
Absolutely correct. Which again, by creating the world, you are also creating the characters in that world, and you will have a more empathetic relationship with those characters because, in essence, they're parts of yourself. When they talk about authors, and they say, "Well, you know, what character was most like you?" Well, they're all a little bit like you. There are little aspects of you.
Right.
You know, even the most horrible characters, there's something you can relate to. Even if it's, you know, saying, wow, they're really horrible. It's coming from somewhere inside you. And that's the same thing, again, with you know, again, reading or listening to stories.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I there's definitely something to the idea of the lean back versus the lean in idea. I can definitely see that. I was racking my brain after I read your essay. I was trying to think, okay, now I know I've got some great examples of plays and movies that I've seen that just utterly filled me with empathy, and I
they can. I would never say that they're absolutely empathy free. They're not at all empathy free. In fact, they can create empathy. I'm just saying that there's an added empathy.
Oh, sure, absolutely. I mean, anyway, what I finally came up with was Schindler's List. I said, okay, there.
That's That's a good example.
That one evokes some empathy.
You know,
in our
my
chat
problem
room.
Is with Schindler's List and stuff like that. Is anything having to do with Nazis and the Holocaust? I mean, I'm so there. I can't actually watch it. It's over for me. I'm weeping from the first frame, and it's over.
That movie disturbed me for weeks. I couldn't get it out of my head for a long time. In our chat room, our good friend and regular listener, Matt, mentions that the Internet has the potential for creating empathy. It's sort of what I was kind of getting to earlier, that, you know, it's easy to hate people you don't know. And perhaps the Internet creates possibilities, maybe a space for getting to know people that you would never have an opportunity to know before.
Well, that's one of the things we've talked about, Stephen, is how technology has enabled connections between people that never could have existed before.
Right.
And we use ourselves as an example. Here we are, best of friends, guys, you know, co-doing this radio show together every week, co-doing this blog together. You know, how would we have ever even met without the Internet, right?
No chance at all.
How would we ever even know each other?
Let me throw a wrench in there for a moment.
Sure.
Absolutely. I totally agree. The Internet is an extraordinary connective engine. But here's the flip side. The flip side is, how many times do you go into chat rooms or go onto sites about ideas or concepts that you are not already allied to?
That's true. You tend to go into the echo chambers, don't you?
Exactly right. And
yeah.
The problem becomes, with all of this personalized media, that we're having more and more difficulty knowing what the other people are saying, honestly listening to it, as opposed to getting it filtered through our given persuasions squawk box. You know, whoever's got the bullhorn for the political or social background you come from, you tend to listen to.
Right.
And you're not going to listen to the other side from their own lips. So with the whole idea of personal media, we're actually creating these echo chambers. And even, you know, with social networking, you can't assume social networking is creating any kind of empathy. Instead, I actually liken a lot of it, especially the MySpace kind of, you know, are you my friend? How many friends do you have? it's a prostitution. You know, there's no... these people aren't your friends. It's, you know, love me, want me, buy me, click on friend. There's no real relationship. There's no real empathy building. It's, oh, my God, you think he's hot? Oh, my God. You know, it's...
gosh.
But ultimately, this goes back to what technology does is it enables and it makes so much easier all the stuff that we did anyway.
Right, absolutely.
Right, so we can make friends. We can actually it makes it possible to interact with people in ways that you couldn't before, which also makes all kinds of negative interactions possible that weren't possible before. Because I was just thinking, you know, there are a lot of people who go on to sites where the views are polar opposite of what they believe, so they control, right? People who go onto those sites so they can leave nasty comments and say terrible things.
That's their modus operandi. They're looking to troll.
Yeah, exactly, you know, so they can do that. But even on something like The Speculus, where we don't do political talk, right? We really try to veer away from politics and religion and keep it on the topics that we want to do. We'll occasionally get blog commenters who just don't really seem to grasp how you talk to people, you know? I mean, just kind of the and not so much The Speculist. I guess I see this more on other blogs, I should say. I don't want to talk about my readers so much. But you see this just basic lack of connection with how you interact with other people. And that seems to be part of what is kind of this emerging and rapidly growing geek culture that we contend with. So is it? You know,
and hey, look, I'm all for geek culture. I am a geek.
And that is so refreshing to find a female geek who's just dyed in the wool geek. I mean, that's cool.
We had a lot of those these days.
Born of geeks. So.
And so really, you were destined to be a geek, I guess.
Oh, hey, my father was like one of the first, you know, members of the New York Science Fiction Club or some such thing back in the 40s, 50s, something like that. So, yeah, it was pretty much faded.
Oh, that's great.
Well, one of the things we've talked about is the distinction, actually, between geeks and nerds that we make on The Speculist is that we've claimed that while geeks and nerds live in the same world and they know a lot of the same things, geeks have a certain level of ability to interact with their fellow human beings that nerds lack. So maybe I'm talking more about nerd culture. Maybe that should have been the term that I used, Stephen.
Well, it's interesting because there's... I find, especially working within, again, futurist issues, and I say this knowing that some of these people will be listening to me, that there are a lot of people who have difficulty communicating within both geek and nerd culture, for whom, you know, it's not the top of their skill set, who are fantastic and brilliant at all kinds of things, but social interaction is not their strong suit.
Okay, well, we've got a little fun example of that. Before we roll that, though, Stephen, I just want to say this is Fast Forward Radio on Blog Talk Radio. We're talking with PJ Manning. And, PJ, we have burnt the half hour up much faster than we realized. Can we keep an additional segment?
Yes, stay on with us if you will.
Okay, I would love to.
Okay, fantastic. Steve, so let's wrap that background and let's talk about nerds who nerds and geeks and some of those social interactive disabilities that some of us have suffered from in the past. Stephen, go ahead and I'll just set this up. This is a little audio clip from PJ. Have you seen the CBS sitcom The Big Bang Theory?
No, I haven't.
You need to.
You're not the first.
well, I think what you're about to hear is a representative clip. Just to set it up, this is you've got two geeks living. They're roommates. They live across the hall from this gorgeous young woman. They're all hanging out. The two geeks and two friends who have come over. And she has come and asked the one guy, Leonard, to do her a favor, and this is a little follow-up discussion that occurs between them. So go ahead and play that, Stephen.
Honey, wait. If you don't have any other plans, do you want to join us for Thai food and a Superman movie marathon?
A marathon? Wow, how many Superman movies are there?
You're kidding, right?
Do you like the one where Lois Lane falls from the helicopter and Superman swooshes down and catches her? Which one was that?
One. You realize that scene was rife with scientific inaccuracy.
Yes, I know men can't fly.
No, let's assume that they can. Lois Lane is falling, accelerating at an initial rate of 32 feet per second per second. Superman swoops down to save her by reaching out two arms of steel. Miss Lane, who is now traveling at approximately 120 miles an hour, hits them and is immediately sliced into three equal pieces. Unless Superman matches her speed and decelerates. In what space, sir? In what space? She's 2 feet above the ground. Yeah, frankly, if he really loved her, he'd let her hit the pavement. It'd be a more merciful death. Excuse me, your entire argument is predicated on the assumption that Superman's flight is a feat of strength. Are you listening to yourself? It is well established that Superman's flight is a feat of strength. It is an extension of his ability to leap tall buildings, an ability he derives from exposure to Earth's yellow sun. And you don't have a problem with that? How does he fly at night? A combination of the moon's solar reflection and the energy storage capacity of Kryptonian skin cells. I have 2,600 comic books in there. I challenge you to find a single reference to Kryptonian skin cells. Challenge accepted. We're locked out. Also, the pretty girl left.
Okay.
I love that. And let's just make sure that that PJ's still with us.
I'm so here.
Okay, the pretty girl has not left.
Okay, good. Well, I think that's the classic line at the end. That she's left. I mean, in the middle, they're in their own world, and she's the straight person that just...
I know these guys. They're on the chat list with the Extropy Institute and the World...
are you kidding? That is shockingly similar to conversations I have had in my life. I mean, I watch that, and I go, you know, it's like I've been there. I've had that conversation before, you know? Yeah, I love the guy Raj, the character Raj, who one of the things about him is he is so he has social anxiety disorder, and when he gets around Penny, he can't talk at all. So the only line you get out of him from that whole interchange is, "The pretty girl left." Once she's gone, he can announce that she's not there anymore. But that kind of sums it up. These guys have a tremendous amount of knowledge. Some of it on useful subjects. Some of it on not terribly useful subjects. But the desire to reach out to another human being, which Leonard demonstrates there at the beginning, hey, Penny, wait, you want to come over? We're having Thai food. We're watching movies. Gets subsumed as soon as his buddy wants to get in an argument about
the physics of Superman.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
About the problems that would occur there. Now,
yeah, whenever anybody whips out a calculator, you know you're in big trouble.
That's right.
So the question is, I guess, why are we like that? Why are geeks so? Why do we have such nerdy tendencies? I suppose.
Oh man, if I had the answer to that one, boy, I could bottle it. I think nerds and geeks really want to understand the world around them in a way, in a very specific way, in a way that many people simply don't have the need. They need to understand how the world works.
Right.
And lots of people go through life, and I find this hard to imagine, they go through life not having to know how the world works. In fact, not actually caring at all.
Yeah.
Can you imagine that?
No. No, I can't.
I can't either. No, I cannot imagine.
All three of us, though, PJ, I read a little bit about your bio. I mean, you have a successful social life. You're involved with other people's lives in many, many ways. Phil is successful in his social life. He had wife and kids, and myself as well. There are those who get so into these worlds that they live very lonely lives too. So
they absolutely do.
Yeah.
And look, there's a bit of an elephant in the room, and I'm noticing on the your attached chat blog, people have several times used the word, for instance, autistic.
Yeah.
There's a huge range of how people are wired. And, one of the things that I know, there's a woman named Ann Corwin, who I respect an enormous amount, who is autistic, who's a transhumanist, who writes a great deal about neurodiversity. And she's a very high-functioning autist, who writes remarkably on the subject. And when it is fascinating because, on one hand, she's extraordinarily articulate and very sensitive to many things. On the other hand, it's fascinating when she does not read the emotional content of something, let's say you've written. And she and I have found fascinating. We've gotten into arguments online where we realize we're just simply misunderstanding each other's things because I'm assuming she can read the emotional content of my writing. She isn't, and she assumes that I'm taking everything she says completely literally.
Yeah.
Now, what I find fascinating is nerds and geeks, there is a high percentage, and I'm just going to come out and say it because certainly other people have as well, of people in the autistic spectrum among nerds and geeks.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very specific way of looking at the world. They want to know how it works. That's how they make their way through the world, by understanding how that world works. In its physical sense, its material sense, that's how they deal with the world.
There's a type of autism, and I'm probably going to mispronounce this, but it's Asperger's syndrome.
Asperger's, yes.
Asperger's, okay. And that's basically these people are able to function. They usually hold down jobs, and they might be a math professor.
Many people who are in autistic spectrum are actually quite high functioning.
So, right.
We see a lot of the children who are non functioning as examples, but the enormous percentage of the population, if actually examined, would actually be considered high functioning. But anyway, go on. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and these people are high functioning, and you may not even realize that they have that they would even be considered autistic. But you're right, they're wired a little bit different from the rest of the world. So,
And the question becomes, where did the new wiring come from? Is this a product of technology? Is this a product of because it does seem that setting aside for a moment the fact that we can diagnose it much better than we could in the past, that there is just a lot more autism diagnosed today than there ever was in the past. I mean, that it seems to be a much, much more prevalent problem. Is that an effect of technology, or is it indirectly an effect? Is it something in the environment?
Actually, I think it's interestingly possibly the other way around. I think that technology enables people to function more highly when they might have some part, you know, autistic spectrum issues. I think that they're attracted to technology because that's something that is a very tangible thing that they grok, they get it, and they can work with. And I think they have used to their advantage, interestingly. I mean, all you have to do is look at Silicon Valley. A friend of mine who's an attorney in Silicon Valley says one of the big issues, he's a father, has a child in high school, one of the big issues is how many people who I guess you would diagnose now as adult autists are marrying and having children in Silicon Valley, and their children are autistic.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
So the percentage of kids in the autistic spectrum in the public schools in Silicon Valley are unbelievably high compared
right.
to, let's say, other communities. Now, they're all functioning just fine because they're working within a world where that's not considered unusual. Now, some people think that autism might be, bizarrely, an evolution. This might be a form of a more socially fit.
That's interesting. In light of the earlier discussion about empathy and the ability for people to interact, are we evolving away from certain kinds of human relationships? Is that what that would be saying?
Possibly. You know, who knows? I have no I have no investment in any of these ideas. But I am personally fascinated by the issues around autism within society today, because we clearly have, and you know, going from Hollywood, where everyone is so touchy-feely and everyone is so deeply connected emotionally, even as they lash out at each other in that dog-eat-dog world,
right.
Starting to work now with scientists and futurists, et cetera, who are not wired that way, has been fascinating, because it really exposed me personally to an entire world where there are lots of people who, you know, reading social situations, empathizing quickly, wasn't at the top of their skill set.
Let me ask this, just a little bit of parenting, just a parenting question. If you've got a child that is obviously, you know, really bright, I mean, do you make a big deal out of it, or do you... Do you just act like it's no big deal? How as a parent would you take care? I mean, would you treat that situation?
Well, there are a couple schools of thought. Interestingly, and I tend to believe this one from my own personal experience. There's a very strong school of thought that says don't tell them too much that they're smart, because kids need to know that it's about effort and it's about involvement. It's not about how talented or bright they are. That when kids are told all the time that they're so smart and they're so talented, they tend not to try. And from my own experience being told that, I floated through school. You know, there was no problem, skipped grades, you know, the whole bit. And I didn't try as hard as I could have. I probably could have done tons more if somebody had actually said, you know what, effort's what it's about.
Yeah.
It's about, you know, how you invest into what you're doing. And I can even see it with my own kids, that at a certain level, you know, you can be the smartest person in the world and do nothing. We all grew up with kids who were clearly geniuses, and they did nothing. They were lost.
Yeah,
Maybe but, because they were told they were smart. Actually, there's a piece in Scientific American that I picked up somewhere. Stephen,
also the New Yorker. Yes, exactly.
That talks about that very thing. Maybe you don't want to tell kids that they're smart. Of course, with my own child, I have to tell everyone else how smart she is.
Oh yeah, you and me both, sir.
That's a different matter completely. Well, I think it's just been fascinating. I hate to wrap this up because I know we're going to come up on our time, Stephen, and they will what, stop recording us at some
point? No, they don't stop recording us, but we may lose our live audience. So those in the chat room, if you get cut off, that's why. We're coming up on our 1 hour here, but we can keep going.
Okay, so if we go over, everyone
can hear it. You can hear it later.
Hear the rest on the MP3. So that gives us a little bit of a buffer here to wrap this up. That's good. You know, one of the things that makes me think is that getting back to the notion of the kind of ascendancy of the geeks in Silicon Valley. Actually, I had a discussion about this at the Boulder Futurist Salon a few weeks ago, and we talked about this, the fact that there's a spot in the world, in the economic food chain, for geeks, right, that maybe didn't necessarily exist to the extent that it does today.
And absolutely.
That technology has enabled that niche. And it's, talk about, the triumph of a group who was the other. You know, Stephen and I were talking earlier about how we were geeks before being a geek was cool.
Exactly.
And being a geek still isn't exactly cool. But I think it's very interesting that a show like The Big Bang Theory can exist, and the nerds, the geeks on that show are not the funny neighbors who were there for laughs. I mean, the characters are funny and they're there for laughs, but they're the heroes of the show.
Absolutely. We've definitely, in the last 20 years, Bill Gates is our cultural hero.
Right.
Regardless of what you think of his material, his software, he and others like him represent. I mean, technology is where the world is going. It's always been that way, But we don't look at anything. What's the phrase? If you were born with it, it isn't technology.
Right.
So, but the world is as we often discuss. Technology is accelerating, so technology is becoming more and more evident. Technology has always existed in everyone's lives. It's just the change as the economic engine is what's so staggering, and I believe will only become more so. In fact, it can only become more so as again, our technology accelerates.
And so the change is not only in terms of what we're going to experience technologically, but I guess more importantly, what's going to be happening between us as individuals and within the overall culture is going to be changing as rapidly too.
Well, and also the entire idea of control of that technology, open source, and the idea that suddenly technology isn't something that a company somewhere dispenses to you. It is something that you utilize and create yourselves.
Right.
So who knows? Maybe this is the next evolutionary step. Maybe becoming more technologically based. Certainly, the guys I know who I now look back at and go, wow, okay, you're autistic in a way. These are the guys who are dealing with technology a hell of a lot better than I am.
Right.
All
so
right.
They've got the step forward there. Perhaps.
Yeah. they are the evolutionary step forward.
They're evolutionarily ahead of us.
I'm the Neanderthal.
Well, we all are compared to them. Absolutely. Well, PJ, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak with us tonight and for staying on for the additional segment.
It's been a lot of fun.
Good. Well, I tell you what, we're just gonna while I've still got your recording, I'm just gonna get your commitment right now that you'll come back on again sometime in the near future and we can.
I would love to, and when I can actually really talk about my book, I would love to talk to you guys about it because boy, all this stuff comes up.
That would
yeah.
be That would be great. We look forward to having that to having the opportunity to interview you about the book. When can we look forward to seeing that?
Who knows? I'm hopefully actually finishing my first draft at the beginning of this coming year. So yeah,
I don't think we need to wait for that. I think that PJ, you have a lot to talk about on many subjects. You know, we never got a good Xena or Hercules story.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Before we let you go, can you tell us one just
one anecdote?
One.
Oh
favorite.
My
it's
God!
Xena one.
Again, that's sort of like saying, "What did you write about?"
What's the weirdest thing that ever happened working on Xena? How's that?
The weirdest thing. I'll give you a funny one. Okay, I did an episode called "Is There a Doctor in the House," where Xena goes in to stop a war and, as a sideline, creates Western medicine and teaches Hippocrates everything he knows.
I love that.
Yeah, right up my alley. It was perfect. and in it, an Amazon had to have the first cesarean section. Okay, it should have been called the Amazonian section.
Oh, right.
And she gives birth, because she's giving birth to a centaur, a baby centaur. So it can't come out the normal way. It's too big.
Wait. Could I stop for one moment?
Yeah.
I'm a total nerd here. Because I know that on the show, Caesar was already born and an adult, okay? It is the cesarean section.
Interestingly, you know, if you look back at the shows, we go through about 5,000 years of culture.
That's true. Y'all took in everything, didn't you?
Yeah, you got Homer and Caesar meeting the same people. I love
it. Oh, yeah, totally. So, yeah. You know, we just massacred history. But that was a lot of fun to work on, and I could only be on set for little bits of time because at the time I was pregnant with my first child, Nathaniel. So, and they were blowing smoke into this set, which was, you know, unbelievably toxic, I'm sure. My husband's like, you're going for 5 minutes every hour.
Let me get this right. You're heavily pregnant, and you've written a story about a woman carrying a centaur. Is that right?
Which I've now learned you never do, because I gave birth to my son, and after 30 hours of labor, I had an emergency C-section.
Oh, wow.
And I'm lying there on the table, and, I, you know, 30 hours of labor, man, I'm delirious. And I'm saying over and over, and my husband's looking at me, and everyone in the room thinks I'm out of it. I'm saying, I promise God, I will never write about this again. I will never write about having a C-section again. No, really.
And you were just sure that this was going to be a centaur.
I was sure it was, you know, that one of those bits of creative irony that happens over and over in people's lives where, you know, you write something or you create something and it comes back to bite you in the ass.
Well, I'm sure you got a beautiful baby out of it.
Fabulous baby. Two fabulous babies. But yes, absolutely.
That's wonderful.
That's great. Absolutely perfect. Well, thank you again, PJ, for being with us on the show. We will look forward to talking with you again.
We need to tell our listeners we're going to be an hour earlier next week. That would be 10 Eastern, 9 Central, 8 Mountain, 7 Pacific. And I wanted to announce what the music's going to be. We're got some exit music here. It's Brian Duncan's country punk song. Can you imagine? Country? I didn't know that was a genre.
Country punk. I look forward to hearing that.
Yeah.
All right.
The song is Wake Up. And actually, it sounds to me like Western punk, but be that as it may, I hope you all enjoy it. And PJ, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Okay.
Thank you, PJ, and good night, everybody. We'll catch you on the next Fast Forward Radio.